Welcome to MTSU on the Record. I'm Jenna Logue, and we're coming to you from the campus of Middle Tennessee State University in Murfreesboro, Tennessee, and the studios of WMOT-FM. How do you feel about critters? How do you feel about the animal rights movement? How do you feel about attempts to save the ecosystem and the impact that it has on the habitats of creatures in the wild? Dr. Angela Mertig is teaching a course during the Maymester this year, which is that brief three-week period right between the fall semester, right at the end of the fall semester, on animals and society. She's a professor in the Sociology and Anthropology Department, and we're going to talk to her today about how animals fit into our whole consciousness of how we live. And thank you for being with us today, Dr. Mertig. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Now, this class starts May 17th, is that right?
Yes.
And runs through June the what?
That's a good question. Yeah. I think it's June 2nd or 3rd, something like that.
But that's about 3 weeks, right?
Yes. Yes.
Okay. And you've taught this class before. Tell me basically what is, how are you going to explore animals and humans' relationships with animals through the prism of your discipline, sociology?
Right. Well, I spend a good deal of time at the beginning of the course talking about how sociology has approached the issue of animals, and pretty much sociology has ignored them and has treated humans almost as if we're not animals. And particularly I start talking about one of the founders of social psychology, George Herbert Mead, who went to great lengths to talk about how humans were so different from animals, that only humans have culture, only humans have notions of the self. And sociology, for the most part, still makes those kinds of arguments. But there's been so many developments now in biology and zoology that indicate that other creatures, I mean, not all, you know, necessarily, have evidence of culture, of passing down information that's learned rather than genetic, which is, in essence, what culture is.
Yeah.
Other creatures have possibly the notion of a self. There's another concept out there called the theory of the mind, that they're aware of themselves, at least from what we can tell. Yeah. Now, again, you know, as humans, we can't tell perfectly, but we can't tell what each other's doing either perfectly as humans. So
we tend to think of animals strictly as instinctual because they are not, their intelligence is not as highly developed, supposedly, as human beings' intelligence. But we know that animals are capable of learning because we teach domesticated animals how to behave in certain ways to accommodate our lifestyles.
Absolutely.
When it comes to feeling superior, even though we humans are animals, we are warm-blooded vertebrate mammals,
right.
we are part of the animal kingdom, isn't it passing strange that we love our domesticated animals, our dogs, our cats, our horses, we love our farm animals, pigs, goats, sheep, etc., but when somebody violates society's laws, when they run amok, when they do something that's beyond the pale, we say they're acting like an animal.
Yes, absolutely. We do get into that in the course as well, where we use the terminology of animal to somehow say that if you act like an animal, you're not fully human. And that's been done through the course of history, where people who were considered inferior to the dominant human, you know, within human society, were compared to other animals, you know, very closely, like African-American slaves were compared to apes, for instance.
And Jews in Nazi Germany compared to rats.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Isn't it funny, though, that in this love-hate relationship, when we anthropomorphize animals, when we give them human characteristics, like, say, in a cartoon, we get Bugs Bunny or Mickey Mouse or something else that we find endearing and charming. It is only when these animals become imbued with human characteristics, not like the animals, like, say, in George Orwell's Animal Farm, that we tend to think that they're somehow on our level. We've elevated them to our level because we gave them Mel Blanc's voice or something.
Right, right. Yeah, so humans have a funny way of thinking about other animals, but you might want to, you know, we can even turn that question around. It's almost like we Some people say that we zoomorphize people. We actually take characteristics from other animals and ascribe them to people. We oftentimes ignore that right. part of the equation. But
like saying somebody is foxy, for example.
Right. And so there's a lot of overlap in how we speak about animals, but we speak about humans. And any time that we want to draw comparisons between ourselves and other animals, and we're very funny in the way that we talk about animals, the way that we deal with them. And on the one hand, we revere our animals, but on the other hand, we eat animals and we wear animals, and so it gets kind of tricky.
You suppose you could do an entire women's studies class on just the animal names that men use to refer to women: chicks, birds, foxes.
Absolutely.
And a few that I won't mention here,
yeah.
in the interest of good taste.
Yes.
Talk a little bit about, do you get at all into the societies within animals, oh, like a warren of rabbits, the hive full of bees, the flock of geese, that kind of thing?
Yeah, we don't get do a whole lot with that, but I do talk about how the idea of society, of, you know, creatures essentially of the same species working together for a common goal, is not unique to human beings. I mean, there are other species that work together. And I do talk about some research that has been done. For instance, there's a book that came out recently about a cat colony and about the culture that developed in the cat colony and the relationships there. So I do talk about that a little bit, but the focus is more on how humans have treated animals and how we viewed animals, and then how animals have impacted humans. So I guess I'm still a sociologist at heart, and still I still have the people in there.
Yeah.
You know, I can't lose sight of that. But I do think that's fascinating work that's being done.
How about the way that the relationships between humans and animals have been depicted in the media, not just in the cartoon characters that I mentioned, but say in live action movies? You think of everything from Old Yeller to The Yearling to Born Free, and the emphasis on the relationship between humans and wild animals being basically don't get too attached, because you can't take the wild out of the wild critter, no matter how much you love it.
Mm-hmm.
Do you get into any of that kind of thing at all?
Well, we do talk about, I mean, I don't focus only on like domestic animals, but I do talk about the wildlife animals. But we don't per se get into the specifics, I think, of what you're trying to get at.
Mm-hmm.
So
I'm wondering also if the way humans perceive the entire environmental movement is affected by the way in which we perceive animals as lesser beings.
Yes.
Having lived in Louisiana for a while, I know that it was difficult for environmentalists and scientists to get politicians to take seriously the necessity to protect the barrier islands out there just off the coast, because they provide a natural resistance to the impact of hurricanes.
Yes.
And the basic attitude in the legislature was, well, you know, we're talking about alligators and stuff like that. We're not talking about anything that has a great impact on humans. And how effective is it to make the argument that it hurts the animals if we don't take better care of the planet? Is it just dismissed as namby-pamby naive stuff because we're talking about saving creatures instead of saving people, even though it's all interrelated?
Right, and you see that a lot. You see people saying, well, who cares about that, because those are other animals. And if they don't see the direct connection between how protecting those other animals and protecting their habitats ultimately affects us, as we know about what happened in Louisiana with the hurricane. People, I think we need to make clear that there is a connection there, because people will dismiss if it's just about alligators or if it's just about birds, even though there is a whole contingent of people out there who do care about the alligators and about the birds, regardless of how it impacts humans. But I think you always have to keep in mind that people are inherently selfish. And I think that's true for any species. I mean, we're not unique in that sense either.
Yeah.
So we're inherently selfish, and we'll look for things that benefit us directly. Again, not everybody, you know, does that. I think there are groups of people developing who do seem a little bit more altruistic, if that truly is what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, the basis for human behavior is oftentimes very much linked to ourself and our family, and you know, our humanity's survival first.
Self-preservation is the first law of nature, regardless
yes.
of what kind of a critter you are.
Right. Absolutely.
Yeah. There is a story out of Nashville recently that a woman found out, and would not have found out otherwise, she says, that she had breast cancer because her little kitty cat that she liked to hold up to her chest kept pawing a particular spot on her upper left breast. The next day, it had a bruise on it, not because the cat was pawing it, but it prompted her to go in and get examined, and they found a lump.
Mm-hmm.
And there have been stories like this before of cats or dogs becoming aware of cancer in their masters, their human masters, before the humans are even aware of it. Is there any scientific evidence to back up these anecdotal stories that animals maybe have some kind of a level of intelligence or a sixth sense, even if it's chemically based, that we don't quite understand?
Well, I don't know if there's the scientific evidence that this is, you know, something that happens all the time or whatnot, but I have heard those stories mm-hmm. of animals that seem to know things that we can't seem to pick up. And I think it just goes to show you that different species have different qualities, different uniquenesses. I mean, we like to think that we're completely unique from other animals and only we can do certain things. Well, only dogs can do certain things, only dolphins can do certain things, only lizards. You know, it's like we're all unique in our own special ways. And I think that is interesting that there have been these cases. And yes, I have heard of them, and it's pretty phenomenal.
What is it, turning to a different and slightly darker subject now, about some human beings that makes them want to abuse animals, to kick dogs, to wrap a cat up with duct tape, all of these terrible things that we hear about from time to time, to let horses starve. What is it about people that makes them want to do that to animals?
Well, that's a good question, one that I think, you know, several people ask, you know, when they take my class there. That's often, you know, well, why is it some people do this? And as a sociologist, I mean, I tend to focus on social aspects of the reason why people do this. Like maybe they saw other people do it, or maybe there's something in the way that they're raised and in their family that leads them to take out their anger some other way. I mean, as a sociologist, I don't readily go to sort of the psychological, pathological stuff, but I'm not going to completely ignore that either. Mm-hmm. But the FBI and people who study crime recognize that there's a strong connection between a person's willingness to abuse other animals and their willingness to abuse humans. And so they see that as an important sign, revealing the possibility of child abuse or domestic violence or possible criminality. And so there's definitely this connection there. But I think we're still trying to figure out, where does that come from? What's going on in the way that people are raised that they're not learning to care about what happens to others? Okay.
Right. I understand that particularly telling with regard to serial killers.
Yes.
That the percentage of serial killers who abused animals as children is especially high, and it proves to be some kind of a telltale sign, according to criminologists. As a sociologist, what does it say about our attitude toward animals that we're still having to kind of scrape and scratch together ways of dealing with the excess pet population? Mm-hmm. Shelters are always desperately in need of money. There's not enough places to put all the stray animals that have no home. And the number of no-kill shelters is significantly smaller than the number of shelters that will ultimately put animals to sleep if they can't find good homes for them. What does it say about our priorities as a society?
Well,
and I don't ask that in a moralistic kind of way, or to be flip, but just to get us to thinking about where this stacks up with regard, by comparison to all of our other priorities: education, health care, transportation, and so forth.
Well, it's definitely lower I think it's people don't see that as big of a problem, perhaps, as how much tax they pay or education. And you know, there are a lot of important issues competing for our attention. And how we treat animals oftentimes comes lower. But it's not the only one that gets down there either. I mean, there's all kinds of issues that don't get enough attention in society. So I think we oftentimes don't prioritize. Now, sometimes it is interesting to see that sometimes debates happen where people get more upset about animal abuse than they might get upset about something that's happening to women or to children. And so then you get people getting upset, like, why are we putting animals first? Why are, you know?
That's a different kind of objectification.
Yes. And so my reaction to that is, like, these are all important issues, and we need people working on all of these issues. And so we shouldn't be competing. You know, unfortunately, that sometimes happens, you know, because there's not enough resources and time to go around to take care of these issues.
Yeah. There is a difference between, or you do differentiate in your description of the course between the animal welfare movement mm-hmm. and the animal rights movement. To talk a little bit about the different missions and the different goals of those two different collections of activists.
In general, and there's so many varieties of these groups, but in general, the animal welfare movement holds as its goal better treatment of animals, but the continued use of them. So it's okay to keep eating animals as long as we treat them better. It's okay to use animals in medical research, but we need to have better facilities. We need to make sure that we protect the animals while they're in the care of the researchers. Whereas the animal rights movement is for the total abolition of the use of animals. So no eating animals, no wearing animals, no testing on animals. And so that's a big difference, where the one wants to completely get rid of use of animals for any human purposes. The other one says, the welfare movement says, it's okay to use animals, but we need to do that with compassion and with caring.
Why do some organizations in the animal rights movement perform such publicity stunts to gain attention to their cause as to be not only outrageous in the minds of a great deal of the public, but also to the extent of even being repulsive or counterproductive?
You're probably talking about the Animal Liberation Front.
Or PETA,
sometimes. Or PETA, although PETA per se doesn't, well, okay, PETA per se doesn't say that it mm-hmm. supports the Animal Liberation Front activities, but there's right. possibly some connection there.
And there's also a group called Earth First that sticks mm-hmm. Great big spikes in trees that loggers cut down, and then when the saws come across it, then there's a great potential for the logger to get hurt, you know.
Right. And those groups, by and large, argue that they're trying to prevent violence to people. And so they go out of their way. I mean, this is what they say. They go out of their way to do these activities in such a way that it's not supposed to hurt people. So Earth First, for instance, tries to warn the logging company ahead of time, saying, look, your trees are spiked, because they don't want the trees to get cut down.
Right. I don't want the spotted owl to die, but I don't want the logger to die either.
Right. So these groups, you know, take it, they're very serious about their causes. And so they probably are very frustrated with going through the system, that they don't feel that it's working fast enough, that, you know, the environment is getting harmed, animals are getting harmed. And so they feel sort of a rage. Mm-hmm. You know, that's at least the terminology that they use, mm-hmm. that they feel that they need to engage in those kinds of activities.
Or maybe they don't feel things are going fast enough.
Right. And they are considered, the Earth Liberation Front, which is an even more radical kind of an offshoot of Earth First, and the Animal Liberation Front are considered domestic terrorist groups by the FBI. They used to be considered number one, but they've been supplanted by the right-wing extremist militia-type groups right now.
Uh-huh.
But so they are taken seriously because there is the potential for danger to people from mm-hmm. these activities. But again, by and large, these groups say that they're not trying to harm people.
Right. There is something worth examining about the kind of person who feels so deeply connected to animals and feels so strongly about a cause that they might do something illegal, like break into a laboratory
yes.
and free the critters from the cages in order to make a point. Right. From a psychological and a sociological standpoint.
Right. And I think that there are parallels in other movements. I think, Operation Rescue, for instance, the argument to kill the doctors who perform the abortions. I mean, it takes, particular groups, particular individuals to advocate for that kind of activity, which most people would say, aren't you taking that a bit far?
Mm-hmm.
Aren't you the means are not justified, you know, that even though your goal, we might agree with your goal or not,
right.
What you're doing is not appropriate.
Now, also, if you bomb an abortion clinic, not only do you kill the doctors and the nurses, but suppose there is a pregnant woman in there, then you have defeated your own purpose at the time. If you're, the funny thing about women and old jokes dating back to goodness knows how long ago about women's intuition or women's instinct, either dismissing it or mocking it or marginalizing it, that sort of thing. But, you know, if we are all animals, as indeed we human beings are animals, and animals are instinctual, then why is it so far-fetched to think that human beings also have instinct?
Right.
And like to think we're so, we like to think that we are the reasoned creatures, that we use reason and we're so far above it all. But we, since we're animals, we have instinct too, don't we?
Yes. And that's another issue that we talk about in the class, is that because we're animals, we have, you know, similarities to other animals. We have instinctual behaviors. We don't like to talk about them all the time, right? Mm-hmm. We like to kind of ignore them and put them aside. And at the same time, other animals have similarities to us, right? So there is this connection. But we like to, as human beings, you know, we are the ones that gave ourselves the name Homo sapiens, which means wise, you know, wise person, you know. We like to think of ourselves as completely unique in terms of our capacity to supersede our genetics, that we're no longer biological. We're cultural. We're above that. You know, we're different.
Yeah. How does religion play into the human society's attitude toward animals? You know, John Muir, the famous conservationist in California, his attitude toward the preservation of the environment came from his deep religious faith. It was his opinion, he was a Presbyterian, for what it's worth, that human beings must be stewards, good stewards of God's creation. But in the 60s and 70s, the environmental movement, which was kind of in its infancy and taking it to the next level, was not so associated with any kind of a faith-based movement, and it was easy for opponents to dismiss it as, you know, a bunch of wackos. Talk about the different ways that our belief in God, for those of us who are people of faith, plays into how we feel about how we treat animals.
Yeah, and again, there's different components here. John Muir is an excellent example of someone who actually took religion and said, we need to, you know, this creation is beautiful, we need to take care of it, and the religion, you know, was infused in everything that he talked about in that sense. The contemporary environmental movement, the contemporary animal rights movement, probably not so much the animal welfare movement, but tends to be sort of a overall sort of divorced from religion, and I think that's because There have been some arguments over time. There was a famous article that was written in the Journal of Science in the 1960s by Lynn White about how religion was sort of a major reason why we were in our ecological crisis. Now, that argument has been debated back and forth, but the idea that particularly in Judeo-Christian cultures, there's this idea of this mastery over nature, that we were meant to rule over nature and therefore we could do what we want. And so some people argue that those don't go together. But on the other hand, there's a whole series of religious groups who are coming out very strongly for protection of the environment, that we are a steward, that this is a beautiful creation, and it's our responsibility to take care of it. So I think there's just completely different groups, you know, aligning themselves on different different parts of this argument.
The Native American religions, in fact, did they not consider nature to be as a god? Their environment was their god, and they felt a great necessity to respect the land because it was a worshipful thing to do.
Yes, the land was considered sacred for Native Americans, by and large, and that's.
They killed animals, but if they killed a buffalo, they used every part of the buffalo, no waste.
Right.
They didn't do it for the sheer ego gratification of being able to say that you're a great hunter or anything.
Right, right. And that's typical of cultures that are not agricultural or industrial, that they tend to be more animistic in the sense that the nature is sacred. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's not, 100% all cultures like that who are mm-hmm. pre-agricultural. But that is very common, that nature is sacred and that you don't just wantonly destroy the environment because that's your faith, that's your mm-hmm. religion, that's what you believe in.
It would be like destroying a part of your soul.
Absolutely.
Yeah. How do our attitudes toward animals differ from the American society by comparison to other societies around the world? To what extent does geography and culture, ethnicity, all of that play into it?
That's a big question.
That is a big question.
I think because America, when once Europeans were here and took over the country, because of the frontier nature of our society, I think we have more of a leave us alone kind of mentality, a rugged individualistic. I mean, that's very much a part of our culture that we pride the individual and the struggle and things like that. And that's not necessarily the case in other cultures. And you can see, for instance, in Japan, there's much more of a collectivist culture. In Europe, there's a lot. It's a lot more. People are a lot more concerned about environment and animals, and the green parties are more successful. It's not just their attitudes; it's also the way their systems are set up. But we definitely are different in many ways in that sense.
Mm-hmm. And what about the difference between industrialized nations and what we used to call third world countries, but now we would call developing nations,
right.
Particularly some of the African nations and the tribal perspective on animals as opposed to people who think more in terms of being part of a nation state than they do as being part of a tribe?
Right. Well, industrial societies sort of have this love-hate relationship, I think, with animals, because on the one hand, we've gotten to the point where we are secure enough overall, not everybody, overall, where we can have animals that we set aside and don't use per se, although some people would argue pets are used in some mm-hmm. sense. But we have this where we now have insurance for pets and things like that that you wouldn't have thought of in an agricultural society.
Then an entire industry with the veterinarians and medicine.
Absolutely.
And all this sort of thing.
Absolutely. So industrial societies have that, but on the other hand, they have factory farming, massive production of animals for the consumption, for our wearing, for eating. So we have sort of this, depending on what animal you're talking about, mm-hmm. we have sort of this love, set aside versus consume idea. Whereas in agricultural societies, you probably, it's very different than that. And pre-agricultural societies, like we said, there's probably more of a respect. Again, it depends. I mean, mm-hmm. there are important cultural differences that okay. we can't overlook.
There are some international cooperative agreements. The Kyoto Protocol, which is more about the animal's environment or the habitat, protecting it from CO2 and the destruction of the ozone layer, than it is about the animal per se, but say laws regulating whaling that are
yes.
international in nature. There's certain cooperative agreements among nations with regard to animals. I mean, I can't think of any others right off the top of my head. They're probably of only a handful that specifically pertain to how countries treat animals, fish and such.
In endangered species, there's
right.
rulings about that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It's fascinating and multifaceted, and perhaps we even in this brief time that we have, tried to cover more territory than the class itself encompasses. But I appreciate your patience with me on that. And
well, thank you very much.
The class is the first. It's about 3 weeks. What we call the Maymester, right at the end of the spring 2010 semester, starting May 17th. It's called Animals and Society, in the Department of Sociology and Anthropology, taught by Dr. Angela Mertig. Thanks for being with us today.
Thank you.
This is MTSU on the Record. I'm Jenna Logue. You can join us again at this same time next Sunday. And please check out the podcast at your leisure at mtsunews.com. We're also available on iTunes.